Now we are today in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, toward the end of the chapter, and we'll go on into chapter 10. Chapter 9 and then on into chapter 10. In our last study together, chapter 8 verse 16 through 9:12, we saw that both wisdom and labor are impotent to help us get anywhere. You can't count on wisdom to figure out what your life is all about. Chapter 8, verse 17, "Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it." Wisdom cannot answer our questions. It's not an answer to life. And furthermore, our own labor, our own works are futile. They're empty. They take us nowhere. Chapter 9, verse 2. "All things come alike to all. There is one event, even to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath." Verse 11, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. But time and chance happeneth to them all." Wisdom is futile. Labor is futile. Time and chance run through our world and toss us about at every turn. And now we're at a very crucial crossroads. One response to that observation, which is a true observation about the world, one response to that observation would be to say, well then, if wisdom is futile and labor is futile, I won't seek wisdom. I won't do anything. This is the existentialist conclusion. People like Sartre and Camus, who realize that the world is full of chance. Time and chance happen to all men, and they say, there's nothing. There's no meaning. The world is empty. It makes no sense to do anything at all. And in fact, that movement in its purest and most consistent form ends up advocating suicide, because there is no meaning to life. And the only thing to do is just check out. That's not the recommendation of Kohelet. His observation about the state of the world is a true observation. That's the way the world is. Wisdom will not guarantee you success. Labor will not guarantee you success. If you live your life building it upon wisdom or upon labor, hoping to arrive one day at some great goal, you might reach that goal. And when you get there, you'll find yourself in the company of other people who got there without doing a thing. And you'll kick yourself and say, why did I work so hard? And on the other hand, you might not get that goal. You will have worked and labored and struggled and wrestled in vain. Now that's a true observation. That's the way the world is. But the answer is not the existentialist answer of checking out. The answer is that God commands us to be wise, and God commands us to work. And that's what Mr. Preacher is going to do now. In the two sections following the section we just studied, first he's going to tell us, why should I seek wisdom? Okay, you've told me that wisdom is not going to guarantee my success in life. Is there any value to wisdom? Yes, there is. Today we're going to study these verses, 9:13 through 10:15, that tell us why we should seek after wisdom, why we should be wise in our lives. And then, in the following study, chapter 10, verse 16 through 11, verse 6, why should I labor? Why should I work? Why should I exert myself? In both cases, of course, we'll see that wisdom and labor are valuable. They are important. You know that from Solomon's words in the book of Proverbs, and you'll know it now from Ecclesiastes, too. The trick is that our motive is different. We do not seek to be wise in order to make ourselves great. We do not work to make ourselves great. There's no guarantee that those things will come to pass. Rather, we seek wisdom, and we work hard in order to serve God, because he has called us to this work, and it is pleasing to him that we exert ourselves in this way. And if we thus live in obedience to his commands, we will please him. I think it's clear, though, that when we seek wisdom and when we exert ourselves in labor because we receive those as God's task for us, it's impossible with that kind of a motive to overdo it. It's impossible to lose yourself in your work and in your search for wisdom if you really are doing it because God has given it to you and you are doing it as a command from Him. There's no way that could block out the other commands. It's only when we let wisdom and labor become ends in themselves that they run away with us and we find ourselves trapped in the rat wheel of 20th century life. Okay, chapter 9. Beginning at verse 13, we have here a little story about what wisdom can and can't do, and then a comparison of wisdom and folly, followed by the study of the effects of folly in three spheres: leadership, labor, and speech. Chapter 9, verse 13, a little story about wisdom and folly. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city, and few men within it, and there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Now, there was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Here's a very little story, very simple story. Starts off, there was a little city and few men in it. So we'll draw ourselves a city. Here is a city with a wall around it. And there weren't very many soldiers inside the city. Up to the city, there comes a great king. Long robes and a crown on his head. And of course, great kings usually have with them huge armies. So we'll put a huge army out here. And he built fortifications around the city. He besieged it and built great bulwarks against it so nobody could come out or go in or get food. Now, there was found in this city a poor wise man. You know what he did? He, by his wisdom, saved the city. How did he do that? I don't know how. He swallowed the cow. But he did. Somehow he found a way to swallow this king up. I don't know, maybe he persuaded the king that the city was too small for him to waste time with. Maybe he found a way to dig a tunnel underneath the wall, underneath the king's camp, and get outside and get food in. Maybe he was a real good shot with a bow and arrow, and he taught all the archers how to shoot, and they shot the king's arrow. I don't know how he did it. By his wisdom, he managed to get the king away from the city and deliver the city. And yet, no one remembered that same poor man. When it was all over, and the king was gone, and the people inside the city were happy instead of sad, nobody remembered the poor wise man. He was forgotten. Now, Solomon draws a lesson from this in verse 16. I said, wisdom is better than strength. Yep, that poor man's wisdom defeated all the strength of the army on the outside. Who would have thought that he could have done that? One poor man defeated the whole army. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Nobody recognizes him. He didn't get rich or famous. Before the war, he was a poor wise man, and after the war, he was a poor wise man. And it didn't make any difference to him, except, of course, for the fact that the city didn't get burned down, and he didn't get taken away captive. The bottom line is that his wisdom was good. It solved a problem. It protected the city from destruction, but it didn't really benefit him directly in any way. He was still poor. It didn't make him rich. Wisdom is good only if you are content to see the general prosperity of others. It doesn't guarantee you any happiness yourself. If your objective is to satisfy yourself, wisdom is futile. If your objective is to be useful to God and be an instrument of His ministry to others, wisdom is important. this poor wise man ministered to others. God used him to deliver the city, but didn't benefit him at all. Well, let's step back and let's look more generally at wisdom and folly side by side. And I'll ask you a question, and that is, which is more powerful, wisdom or folly? They're the opposites. Folly is what a fool does, and wisdom is what a wise man does. Well, we might think to ourselves, the Sunday school answer says that wisdom is greater than folly. But you know Mr. Preacher well enough to know that he's not going to let the obvious truths remain unchallenged. And he's also going to suggest to us that there is a sense in which folly is greater than wisdom. Wisdom is greater than folly. And yet folly is greater than wisdom. Depends on how you look at it. Wisdom solves practical problems better than folly did. That poor wise man in the city, wisdom could get that king away. Folly couldn't. Wisdom is greater than folly. And yet, a little folly can undo a whole lot of wisdom. A little folly can undo a whole lot of wisdom. You know, the world is fallen. The world is naturally disposed to foolishness. The natural trend of things is foolishness. So, wisdom is like stacking up blocks. It might take you all day to build an elaborate structure out of blocks. It only takes one misdirected soccer ball to knock the whole thing down to the ground. And if you grew up with brothers or sisters, you probably had experiences either of being on the wisdom side and building the building, or being on the folly side and kicking the soccer ball and making it all come crashing down. Wisdom is greater than folly in its impact on the external world. But folly is greater than wisdom in that folly can really mess up wisdom. This brings good results. This brings bad results. Well, first of all, in verse 17, we have a series of little proverbs now, and they fall on one side or the other of this table. Verse 17 shows us that wisdom is greater than folly. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. You'll notice that the word "are" is in italics. It's not there in the original. The translators put it where they thought it made sense. I'm not sure I agree with them. As verse 17 reads, it says that the words of wise men are heard more than the cry of the fool. And yet verse 16 just told us that nobody really pays attention to the wise man if there's a foolish alternative to go after. People will generally follow the foolish opinion rather than the wise one. Well, if you take that word "are" and move it to the right, three words, which the syntax of the sentence allows, then you get this. The words of wise men heard in quiet are more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. The words of wise men heard in quiet are more, that is, they are stronger, they are better, than the cry of him who rules among fools. Look at the contrast here. We're comparing a wise man to one who rules among fools. The one who rules among fools is the fool of all fools. This is the ultimate fool, the fool than whom no one is a greater fool. So you've got a wise man and a foolish fool. And what does a wise man do? His words are quiet. He doesn't shout. The fool, on the other hand, utters a cry, the cry of him that ruleth among fools. You know, you can always tell where a politician's weakest points are by watching where he raises his voice. When you watch a preacher, he'll pound the pulpit precisely at those points where he gives the least support. Folly has to be conveyed by some kind of strong gesture or loud noise for people to follow, because there's no logic behind it. So there's no logic. You've got to find some other way to communicate it. Wisdom, on the other hand, is quiet. You don't have to shout about it. It carries its own conviction. And, Mr. Preacher says, these quiet words of wise men are more powerful than all the hollering and yelling and shouting that fools do. Wisdom is greater than folly. Verse 18 really belongs on both sides of this diagram. It really sets this contrast out very clearly. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Well, we saw that with the man in the city, didn't we? Foolishness couldn't drive the king away. Weapons couldn't drive the king away, but the wise man could. And yet, verse 18, one sinner destroyeth much good. One sinner, one soccer ball knocks the whole house of blocks down. One sinner destroyeth much good. Notice something here. We've been talking about a contrast between the wise and the fool. In verse 18, what's the contrast between? Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but what corresponds to wisdom here in verse 18? One sinner destroyeth much good. And what do you think of as the opposite to sinner? Righteous. I think there's something important to keep in mind here. These are the correspondences that we usually think of. Wise corresponds to fool, righteous corresponds to sinner. But you'll often find verses here and in Proverbs where the wise man is contrasted with the sinner, where the fool is contrasted with the righteous. Now, what do contrasts like this, these single arrows going diagonally, what do contrasts like that tell you about the sense of wise and fool in the Bible? Well, there's a sense in which the fool is the sinner and the wise man is the righteous one. If I use the word wise in talking to you, say, boy, that person is really wise, you probably would take me to making a statement about his IQ, his intelligence, his mental abilities. If I say someone is a fool, you think, oh, that means he's stupid, he's dull, he's slow-witted, maybe not terribly gifted above the shoulders. That's how we use wise and fool. That's not how the Bible uses wise and fool. What's the beginning of wisdom in the Bible? Fear of the Lord, right. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And what does the fool say in his heart? There is no God. These are not, fearing God and denying God are not intellectual activities. In fact, from the standpoint of IQ, people with the highest IQs tend to deny the existence of God, and people with fairly limited sophistication intellectually tend to be more ready to participate in some sort of a religion. Just in the general, not many in the world sense wise, not many mighty, not many noble are called, Paul says. And he's using wise there in the Greek sense, the modern sense of the word. But here in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, wise is a moral term, not an intellectual one. Fool, folly, that's a moral term. It's not an intellectual term. When we contrast the wise and the fool, we're talking about the righteous and the sinner. It's important to keep that in mind when you, for example, read the book of Proverbs. I'll give you one example. What some of us have talked about. Folly is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now, what is it that we're to use the rod to drive away from the child? Intellectual clumsiness? Well, yes, if we take folly in the modern sense of the word, oh, you're foolish, you spilled your milk. But if we take it in this sense of the word, the folly that's bound up in the heart of the child there is the sin that that child inherits from Adam. That innate wickedness that we all come from and that shows itself in wicked, rebellious actions. And that, I think, is what Solomon is telling us to use the rod to drive away. It's folly in this moral sense. Folly in the sense of rebelliousness, wickedness. And many other times you'll find it useful to recognize that in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, wise and fool are primarily moral terms. They are not intellectual terms. Now, that's not the case throughout the Bible. I just gave you a verse in Corinthians where Paul says, not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble has God called. And wise there is used in the intellectual sense, the university graduate. God has not called nearly as many PhDs as he has high school grads. But when we're in these books, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, these are moral terms. And we see that right here. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner, one fool, destroyeth much good. Now, chapter 10, verse 1, gives us a verse on this side, where folly is greater than wisdom. And you've often heard me quote this one. That's because I have problems with this in my own life, so I have to keep reminding myself. so it's easy to remind you. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to give forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Or, actually, at the second half of the verse, a little folly is more weighty than wisdom or honor. It's probably a preferable translation. A little folly is more weighty than wisdom or honor. We've got a picture here and then a truth that comes forth from the picture. The picture is that you've got a jar of choice perfume. Chanel number 5. Some with a nice hand lotion or something. It's very sweet smelling and a little bit sticky. This is an ointment. This is an oil. It's not just a water base, not just toilet water. This is really good stuff. And you left the lid off it one day, sitting in your bathroom, and being in Israel 3,000 years ago, you didn't have screens on the windows. So here sat your perfume with the lid clumsily left off. And by the window there comes buzzing a fly. And he sees this little pot of ointment here with this delicious fragrance coming out of it. And you know what that fly does? He lands. There he is. That's a fly. He lands in the ointment. Smelled so good. Once he got down there, he discovered that it wasn't really good to eat after all. So what did he try to do? He tried to fly away. We're stuck. Both feet stuck. No, not both feet stuck. All 6 feet stuck. Poor fry. Not too long before, he's a dead fly. He's not alone. Lots of flies smell this sweet perfume. Lots of flies come land in the perfume. Whole surface of the perfume is now covered with flies. Some of them struggling, some of them weakening, most of them dead. And after a few days, this beautiful jar of perfume that smelled so sweet now starts to smell like a jar full of dead flies. It stinks. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. The Hebrew is quite picturesque here. It says, they cause it to stink, they cause it to bubble. And he just pictures these flies here sort of fermenting. All foamy with all the putrefaction that's in there. That's the picture. You got that picture firmly in your mind? Okay. In the same way, folly is more powerful, more weighty than wisdom and honor. A little bit of folly spoils the whole thing. You can seem very wise to people. You may give good counsel. Seem a very godly person. One lapse into folly on your part will wipe out all of that. Just think of the qualifications that God holds up for those who would lead his people. Some of us have been thinking a lot about this recently, haven't we? Doesn't take much to disqualify a man from leadership in the church. Husband of one wife, a divorce and a remarriage, that's it for the rest of his life. Cannot lead in the church. Not because God is unforgiving, but because a little folly, just a little folly, outweighs wisdom and honor. And this is why it's so important for us to mind our speech with one another. People will retain in their minds a picture of us, not on the basis of all the hundreds and hundreds of very wise things that we've said, but the few little foolish jests that we have made. Those are the ones that will leave a lasting impression. Those will be the dead flies that cause the ointment of the apothecary, the wisdom of God, to turn putrid and rancid and cause people to turn away from it. So here's a good example of really a case where folly is more powerful than wisdom. You see how, although it's only wisdom that can solve the world's problems, just a little folly can mess up all that wisdom. Verse 2. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. Now this is a statement that belongs over here. With apologies to Dave, most people in the world are right-handed. For most people in the ancient world as well as this world, the right hand is the skillful hand, the left hand is the clumsy hand. What the proverb says is that the wise man has his heart in his right hand. Foolish man has his heart in his left hand. Now, why would you walk around with your heart in your hands? In fact, we talk about having your heart in your hands. It has an entirely different meaning. The heart for the Israelite is the organ of thought and intelligence. That's where thinking takes place. That's where skill is lodged. What he's claiming here is that there is a link between the moral sense of wise and foolish and the intellectual sense. The wise man, the one who fears God, will be skillful with what he would say his mind. His mind, his heart, is in his right hand. That is, he's very skillful and adept in his ability to cope with situations, to understand the world, to figure things out. The foolish man has got all of his understanding in his left hand. He's as clumsy in dealing with day-to-day matters as most of us are in manipulating things with our left hand. And Dave, if you want to make the Dave Nelson version of the book of Ecclesiastes, you just swap the two around. Okay? The point is that wisdom is much better than folly in terms of solving practical problems. That's true. Even though people with the high IQs may tend to deny God, in terms of understanding how the world works, really having a godly perspective on things and being able to succeed in God's eyes, is the wise man, the man who fears God, who has his understanding in his right hand. So there often is a link between the moral sense of the term and the intellectual sense. The wise man will, in general, be more intelligent and more facile. The wicked man will lose out in intelligent action. And finally, in 10:3, we have another case where wisdom was greater than folly, which really follows very close on the heels of verse 2. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. The word his wisdom here literally is his heart. And we're talking here about this heart in his left hand. The fool can't get his mind into gear. That's what's happening. When he walks by the way, his wisdom fails him. As he goes about his daily life, he just can't get everything together, and as a result, everyone around sees that he is a fool. He saith to everyone that he is a fool. He doesn't say that by walking around with a sign around his neck that says, I am a fool, no. But the consequences of his actions show that he is a fool. What does the death of Bobby Kennedy's son who died of drugs some years ago, what does that tell you about the family life of his father and his success? What does the Patty Hearst story tell you about the real success of the Hearst family, the great newspaper magnates? What does the end of Hitler, or Napoleon for that matter, tell you about the real wisdom, the real ability to cope with the world of these men? You pick any great man you want, anyone that the world esteems for greatness, and if you look at that person's life from God's perspective, you will see that their wisdom has failed them, and they have proclaimed to all around that they are fools. You'll see that they cannot make their lives succeed, because wisdom in itself is impotent. Man's wisdom is impotent. But wisdom that fears God is the only thing that can guide us in a right life. Still, you have to face up to time and chance. But the fool proclaims to all that he is a fool by his failure in life. Now, we've talked about this little story of the wise man in the city, and we've done a little comparison here of wisdom and folly, and tried to understand the relationship between the two. We've seen that they are moral terms, at least as much as they are intellectual terms, and even more so in the Old Testament. Now we want to look at the impact of folly in three areas. Remember, the purpose of this section is to tell me why I should worry about wisdom. I've just been told back in chapter 9 that wisdom cannot guarantee success. Why should I worry about it? Well, let's look at what the alternative is. Let us consider the consequences of folly in three spheres of human activity. First of all, we'll consider the consequences of folly in the sphere of authority. That's 4 through 7. What happens when a ruler is a fool? Then we'll consider the impact of folly in the area of labor. What impact does folly have on us doing our daily work? And finally, we'll look at the impact of folly on speech, and that's verses 12 to 15. We may not finish all three of these today, but we'll just go as far as we can and take up more next week. What then is the impact of folly on authority? How does it affect rulers? Verse 4. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. And these four verses outline for us the problem of folly in authority. First of all, he'll tell us how you cope with it in verse 4, and then in verses 5, 6, and 7, he'll look at some of the consequences of folly in authority. How do you cope with the problem of a ruler who is a fool? What do you do with a person like that? Verse 4, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee. Here is a ruler, he's angry. He's always angry. He's never happy. He's always upset over something. And if you're around, if you happen to be in the court, you get smashed. Well, fortunately, we don't have kings nowadays, so they can't get mad at us. Unfortunately, we do have bosses, and sometimes our bosses are fools. So it is very practical. How do you cope with a superior who is unhappy with you? He's angry. The spirit of the ruler rises up against thee. What should you do? Well, here's what not to do. Leave not thy place. The great temptation is to tell him exactly what you think and knock his block off. You know that won't work, so don't do that. Another temptation, a very strong one, is to say, I quit. I don't like working for you. I quit. Now, sometimes there is a time to leave a job. I'm not saying that you start a job and you stay with it for all of your life. But you ought not to walk out in a rage. This guy is still the ruler, and if you rebel against him, you're not honoring God. You're not giving him a good testimony. Chapter 8, verse 3, I think, gives the same advice. Verse 2, I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment, and that in regard of the oath of God. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing, for he doeth whatsoever pleaseth him. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. Don't rush away. When you're working for someone, you're under someone's authority, don't place that relationship in continual tension by always threatening to leave. That's not a wise thing to do. It's not going to be productive. All that will do is lead them to question your loyalty and be more angry with you and more suspicious of you. So, 10:4, leave not thy place. For yielding pacifieth great offenses. Now, he's not saying here, give in to the fool and do what he wants. The word yielding here is literally the word healing. Healing pacifieth great offenses. But it has the sense of gentleness, calmness. The word is used, for instance, in Proverbs 12:18, which is, on the whole, a very helpful parallel to this passage. Proverbs 12:18. There is that speaketh like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise is health. Some people talk and they're like a sword when they talk. They're always stabbing and jabbing and being hurtful, but the tongue of the wise is literally healing. This is the kind of answer you give to an angry person. A gentle answer. A calm answer. Remember what we read back in chapter 9, the words of wise men heard in quiet are greater than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. A quiet, gentle, kind answer. Need not agree with the folly, but it can soothe the wrath. Proverbs 15, verse 1 is probably the best known advice along these lines. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. When someone over you behaves in a foolish way, you don't go along with their folly, but you should answer them in a gentle, kind, peaceful, healing way. Doesn't mean that the content of your words agrees with what they're trying to suggest, but it does talk about the form of your answer. It is to be a healing answer. There's no place in the Christian's relationships with other people for harsh, cutting words in general. Now, there will always be exceptions. You read the epistles, you'll find some places where Paul is very forthright and very strict. And even so, every time he starts a book, he tells his readers how wonderful they are, how great they're doing, how fine everything is. Now, by the way, there are a couple things I'd like to talk to you folk about, and then he lands into them. But it's the healing words, the soft answer. The tongue of the wise is health. That's how you deal with folly in an authority, in a ruler. Let's look at the form that that ruler's folly will likely take, and then we'll stop for the day. Verses 5 through 7 show us this evil that proceeds from the ruler. And that is that folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. He can't figure out who's wise and who's not wise, who's noble and who's not noble. And so he exalts one and puts down the other. He puts servants riding around on horses. They ought to be walking. The princes who should be on horses, they're walking like servants upon the earth. In other words, he disposes his people inappropriately throughout his administration. He puts fools in control and does not take advantage of the wisdom of those who are wise. A leader who is foolish will tend to build a foolish organization. That's the statement. That's the insight that's being given here. A leader who's foolish will tend to build a foolish organization. And when you're in the middle of that kind of an organization, you need to respond to the difficulties that come your way with patience, kindness, and gentleness, not with anger. But for all that, wouldn't it be better if we didn't have organizations like that? Wouldn't it be better if the people in control knew how to do the jobs they were supposed to do, and the people who were under them were in a learning situation and recognized that they needed to learn? And we didn't have this inversion with the fool on top and the wise man on the bottom. Certainly that would be the better way to run the world. And that's why you should strive after wisdom. If you have any responsibility for other people at all, even though wisdom by itself is impotent to guarantee your happiness, you need wisdom to organize the work of those for whom you are responsible. If you're a family leader, if you're a father or a mother, you need wisdom to be able to guide your children appropriately. If you have responsibility in a local assembly, you need wisdom to be able to guide the assembly. Wisdom will not guarantee your happiness, but it's essential if you want the organizations for which you are responsible to function effectively. And that's one reason why you should seek after wisdom. Wisdom is greater than folly in that it allows you to solve practical problems. Now, I think we'll stop here. Next week, we'll go on and look at the effect of wisdom or folly. He approaches each of these things by saying, wisdom can't solve all your problems, but it's a lot better than folly in respect of each of these areas. We'll look at the impact of folly on labor and on our speech. And then we'll go take a look at why we should pursue labor rather than sitting on our hands all day and doing nothing. The wisdom of God has been committed to us in His Word. That's the greatest source of it. Why don't we stand and sing in closing Psalm 19 in our Bibles to remind us of the purity and healthfulness of God's wise revelation to us. Psalm 19, verses 7 through 11.